Good afternoon. Your municipal station presents another in the series, Folk Songs of America, featuring that great Negro folk singer of Louisiana, Huey Leadbetter, better known to you as Leadbelly. And Leadbelly has as his guest today the dustiest dust bowler of them all, Woody Guthrie of Oklahoma.
60 years ago, the legendary Leadbelly had a weekly radio show on WNYC, as you've just heard. It was called Folk Songs of America, in which he showcased the work of fellow musicians along with his own. And what we just heard was the opening to the December 1940 broadcast, in which a relatively unknown folk singer named Woody Guthrie appeared on the show playing his songs and telling how he came to write them. Radio shows were not routinely taped in those days as they are now, but this one happened to be recorded on an acetate disc and was recently rediscovered by WNYC's archivist Andy Lancet. Leadbelly's show was produced by a young ethnomusicologist named Henrietta Yuchenko. She's now a professor emerita of CCNY, as well as the author of three books, including a biography of Guthrie. I'm very pleased that Ms. Yuchenko was able to join us today to share this historic recording with us. Hello.
Hello.
Normally, we have to give our guests precise directions to our studios and then hope they don't get lost, but that wasn't a problem in your case. You worked here from 1939 to 1941 and again in the 1960s?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. The studios look a little different.
Oh, entirely. When I walked into the studio today, to the station today, I couldn't recognize it at all. You really changed everything around.
Yeah, well, this was something else at that time where we are located now, and the studios were in a different part of this floor. And in those days, when you were here, WNYC was all AM, wasn't it?
All AM.
What was the programming like in 39-40?
Well, in the first place, remember, it was a newly independent station. When Mayor LaGuardia was elected, that's what happened. And he appointed his campaign manager, Morris Novick, as its director, its first director. And Novick was a very innovative man, a man with a great deal of imagination. And he decided that WNYC no longer was going to be a political football for, you know, various parties to just do what they wanted to do. And he was going to make it into a cultural station. And that's exactly what he did. And I was the first person he hired at that particular time, and also someone to do radio drama, Mitch Grayson.
But even then, there were debates over what kind of music was appropriate. Now, on FM stations, there are some public radio stations that only want to play little movements of Mozart symphonies because people don't want to hear modern music. And LaGuardia hated contemporary music, didn't he?
He loathed it. As a matter of fact, he really stopped me once at the end of a broadcast. So remember that it was a time during the Depression we were a lot of musicians were arriving from Nazi Germany, refugees, and we put them on the air regularly. But I had a program, one program in contemporary music. It was an avant-garde program. And my husband, I remember, telling me, you know, you really should have a support program because somebody is going to attack you for all of this crazy stuff. And sure enough, the one person who called up to complain was the mayor.
The man who said you should be independent and not be, not have to worry about political pressure.
Well, that's a wonderful story because he complained, you know, the taxpayers' money, I mean, we're wasting all our money on junk like this, and tell Morris to be at my office tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. So at 9 o'clock, Morris went to the office, and I was at the station just kind of a little nervous about what was going to happen to me, you know, for doing this. And pretty soon, Isaac Brimberg, who was then the chief engineer of the station, came into my office and said, oh, just calm down, nothing is going to happen. Because Morris said to him, Mayor, Your Honor, if you want New York to be the capital of world culture, then it doesn't matter whether you like the music or not. And the mayor said, you made your point.
But
and
then
that was the end of it.
But then Leadbelly was a controversial figure. He had spent most of his adult life in prison for assault and murder, including a stretch at Rikers Island for stabbing a man in 1939. And he was associated with leftist politics. So wasn't it a rather adventurous thing to give him his own radio show?
Yes, but that was the beginning of an interest in folk music. And Lead Belly had already achieved a kind of notoriety when he came to New York for the first time, which was, I'm not really quite sure, Leonard, exactly, but I think it is 1936. Mm-hmm. Okay. And because he was a musician.
He'd been in Angola prison.
Yes. Yeah. But he came to New York and under the sponsorship of Alan Lomax. And from that time on, he became a cause celebre because that was the beginning of a folk song movement. And that movement finally included, you know, and then Aunt Molly Jackson from Kentucky, her brother Jim Garland, and her sister Sarah Ogan. And then Woody came here. And again, late in the 30s, and that's when I meet them all.
Mm-hmm. But they
and
don't
Pete
have,
Seeger.
Who had shows, just Lead Belly at that point. Later, Oscar Brand.
Oh, that's later.
Yeah.
I'm post-history. You have to remember that I was here before the flood, or rather, as a matter of fact, I was here when the Dead Sea was only sick. You know, I had a little cold.
Was the Lead Belly show political in any way?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. No, Lead Belly really did not have anything to do with politics. He talked about social issues, and even then, very mildly so. You know, one song about discrimination in Washington, D.C., but for the most part, it was really blues and gospel and work songs and ballads, and that's really what he did every single week.
My guest is Henrietta Yurchenko, who was the producer of that show. She was a young ethnomusicologist at the time that Lead Belly was broadcasting Folk Songs of America. Now she's professor emerita at CCNY. The style of that show was more sing-along, wasn't it? Before Mitch Miller's sing-along, people could write in and get the lyrics to the songs. Was that common? Was that something that other people did, or was this something that you guys invented?
I don't know whether I invented it, but it was a natural outcome of the program. But I think I really ought to describe Lead Belly as he came in. And then the exact, because you see, I do remember that encounter. I remember that day when Woody came to the station to participate on his program, because Woody had already been broadcasting programs on my series called Adventures in Music. And this was the first time that he came. Anyway,
was he famous yet?
Oh, not at all. Mm-hmm. Or let's say that he was famous in a very, very small circle. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the Depression. Remember, this is the Depression era. It's liberalism. I mean, the struggles for unionism. There were demonstrations all the time for one cause or another.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but every single week, Lead Belly would appear just neatly dressed, always. His gray, double-breasted suit, neatly pressed, the white shirt and the little bow tie, carrying his 12-string guitar. Always such a dignified, imposing figure, because, you know, he was really a big man. But there was a gentleness about him that really belied that terrible reputation that he had.
And the music was all played live?
All played by him. It was very rarely that he ever had anybody else on the program. And that one person was Woody.
Mm-hmm. It's said that he had a repertoire of over 500 songs. So he could sing a lot of different things each week.
Oh, sure. Yes. Every week after his broadcast, we would go into my little office and prepare a skeleton script, and then he would reminisce the rest of the way. And people would call at the station and say, who wrote that wonderful script? And I'd say, well, no, nothing. It was just a skeleton that I wrote, and everything you heard was really,
right,
you know,
off the
top words
of his head.
Right.
Maybe we can listen to a little bit of I Went Rowing, a song I don't know from this broadcast in December 1940.
Each week, Lead Belly sings one song which he hopes you will learn to sing too. The words of these songs can be had by simply writing to Lead Belly in care of this station. Last week, Lead Belly sang a number called I Went Rowin' and My Gal Went Too. And in case you didn't hear it, well, Hudie, sing it again.
I went rowin' and my gal went too. Down on the bottom when the boat broke through. Every time she turned around, she said it's so funny. You can't lose me, Charlie. You can't lose me, boy. can't lose to me, Charlie. You can't lose to me, boy. Up the Willow Winston, I went to roadin'. Down on my knees, I was doing a little coatin'. Every time she turned around, she said it's so funny. You can't lose to me, Charlie. You can't lose to me, boy.
Lead Belly performing live on his radio show called Folk Songs of America. And I'm talking with the producer of that show, Henrietta Yurchenko. Obviously, that is blues influence, but he was not a blues singer. He sang some blues, and that's why the show was called Folk Songs of America.
That's right.
Which is really important.
He was a songster. Uh-huh. That was the title he really had.
In fact, his signature song was Goodnight Irene, which he said he'd learned from his uncle, and he used that to open the show each week.
Yes.
It's not a blues in any way.
No.
It later became a hit for the Weavers.
Yes.
But many people remember that song. But that was the only song he repeated every week?
Every week. That was the signature song. That's the beginning.
Mm-hmm. His theme. Yes. And many of the songs were adaptations of traditional songs. It was okay for him to change the lyrics?
He's just like every other folk singer. You take the material and then you do with it what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
There are no rules there. Thank heaven there are no rules. That's why you have this great expansion here in the United States.
And that's why I was surprised to see a song called Frankie and Albert. I think, yes, I know this with a different guy with Frankie.
Yeah. They come in different guises. You know, you can, if you really look hard enough, then you will find a dozen versions of each song.
This afternoon, Lead Belly and Woody are going to sing a program of ballads. These are the songs that tell stories of the important events in the lives of the people. History has condemned men like John Hardy and Jesse James, but in the hearts of the men who knew them, John Hardy and Jesse James are heroes. Most of you remember the old ballad Frankie and Johnny. Well, now Lead Belly sings his version of this song, which he calls Frankie and Albert.
Now, this is Frankie and Albert. Frankie was a hard-working girl. Worked hard in the white folk kitchen. Albert, he wasn't no good. And so Frankie made $100 and paid it all for Albert one suit of clothes. And now this will tell the story about Frankie and Albert. Frankie was a woman everybody know. Made $100 just to buy a man a suit of clothes. Was a man all it done around. Frankie went out walking, did not go for fun. Get on the apron. Albert smoked at 41. Gonna kill my man. All the time, you know.
Eddie Ledbetter, better known as Lead Belly, singing Frankie and Albert on a show that was broadcast December 1940. We don't know the exact day of that show, do we, Henrietta?
I certainly don't remember.
I think I'm told it was December 12th, uh-huh. 1940. And don't want to confuse anyone because we are already into the year 2000 here on WNYC AM 820. The only thing that we haven't, well, even then it wasn't AM 820, it was AM 830, I think, in those days. Because when I came here, we were at 830 and we moved over to 820 when we went fuller power. So this was a show that was on a station that had very weak signal, didn't it?
Very weak.
So it was so popular.
And remember that we had to sign off at
sunset.
Dusk.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because we were Sunrise Sunset Station.
That's right.
Now, nowadays, we think of Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly together as a very special event, but it only seems that way in retrospect.
Yes. In that time, you know, there was a small circle of people that consisted of, finally, of course, Pete Seeger, Alan Lomax, who really did so much. He's the first one to see that Lead Belly's songs and Woody's songs were recorded, and they were recorded on RCA Victor, and those were the first ones. Remember that, Leonard, that all of this was live. Mm. Everything was live at the session, right?
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Well, of course, in this case, Lead Belly is working with somebody he knows. When Woody Guthrie came to New York, he stayed with him, didn't he?
Yes, he stayed with him for a time. But you see, Lead Belly was everybody's teacher. And Woody admired him tremendously, you know, for his skill, not only as a singer and as a guitarist. I think that you really have to say that it is Lead Belly who makes the budding folk singer at that time and forever aware of different styles. In other words, a folk singer in those days, back there in the 30s, would just simply strum, you know, a certain pattern and use a couple of chords, basic chords, and that was it. We'd do
Sounds
it to
like
a
all
blues.
The parties I went to when I was in college.
That's right. So everybody did the same thing. But Lead Belly made them aware that there was a certain style of performance, there was a certain way to play blues, a certain way to play country music and a gospel. And from then on, that today's all of the white guys, you know, who play blues know those styles. And there are lots of, you know, variations within that style. But a basic style had to be understood.
Well, in the case of Woody Guthrie, he had a more talented student than most. And somebody who wrote a lot of his own songs.
Who? Woody?
Didn't he?
Woody wrote 1,000 songs. Woody was a great writer. He was not only a great musician and a great, you know, composer of songs, but he was a great writer as well. If those of my listeners who have read his Bound for Glory know what a really great novel that is, you can say that it's a novel autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
No, because
he
moved things around.
Facts.
Yeah, he took liberty. Well, why not? Because that's when you listen. I've just written my own memoirs, and I know that I have to revise certain things. You don't tell it the way it really happened. You tell it the way you recall it.
And he wrote songs that way too. Some of them have become classics. Others just seem to be the sorts of things that we all think of when we're singing to our kid, for example. And he the difference is that when I make up a song, it goes into the air and disappears, and I forget it. Woody remembered them and recorded them, and we have CDs, 2 or 3 CDs out there that are just of Woody singing to young Arlo.
Well, he loved children, and he wrote songs for children, and he wrote them all down. He wrote everything down. He was in love with his typewriter. As a matter of fact, when he had something to tell me, he wouldn't make a telephone call the way anybody would, living in the city as he did. No, he would write a letter to me and send it to me in the mail so that I, you know, no email at the time. And that is how he communicated. He just adored the typewriter, and he just wrote prodigiously. When I was working on the book, I mean, I saw his letters, and there were numerous letters that he sent to his wife, to Marge, when he was in the Army during the war. But I saw there were novels that never had been published, half-finished, absolute gems. All the books that he read, for instance, had his notation. He'd make remarks about how he felt about this and how he felt about that. That philosopher who was, you know, nuts and crazy and... he was, of course, full of opinions, naturally. But look, we were living in very political times. This is a time when you did think, anybody, a thinking person was thinking politically. You had to.
And so when he wrote songs like This Land Is Your Land, he was making a political point which has been often subverted by the way it's been used since then.
Yes, of course. The one thing about Woody, I think, that we have to remember, Woody criticized what he thought was wrong, okay? He was the kind of singer who, when he performed in the South before unions that were just forming and that were segregated, he wouldn't sing before a segregated audience, okay? So he had no racial prejudice whatsoever, nor religious prejudice. Remember that Marge Mazia, his second wife, was a Jew. He had excellent relationship with her mother, who was a poetess in Yiddish. I mean, a man without prejudice, you know.
But he seemed
but
to...
But on the other hand, he had such a great love for his country. And I think that in This Land Is Your Land, you find that. The criticism there in certain stanzas that are generally omitted from the song, but there is the protest. However, the rest of it is... why shouldn't this great, gorgeous land not be the greatest land in the world?
My guest is Henrietta Yurchenko, who produced the show Folk Songs of America on WNYC from 1939 to 1941. It was Lead Belly's show, and we are playing little excerpts from the December 12th, 1940 show, in which Woody Guthrie came visiting as a guest. Woody, we could call the first of the protest singers? Or was he coming out of a tradition that has largely been lost?
Perhaps so, in a certain way, because Woody already was writing songs during the long period when he was living in Texas, but they were kind of non-political. It was on, you know, on certain issues, like kind of people's protests of the time. It is only with the Dust Bowl songs that he really becomes prominently a protest songwriter.
He wrote songs about current events, books, and movies. In fact, the Dust Bowl, the great Dust Bowl movie, Grapes of Wrath, when that came out, it made a great impression on him, and he wrote a song. Maybe we can listen to a little bit of the Ballad of Tom Joad.
Well, I think now we're going to sing you one. Here's a song here that has to do with a book and a motion picture that come out here a while back by the name of The Grapes of Wrath, wrote down by a man, John Steinbeck, that threw a pack on his back and went right out amongst the people to see just what was going on in the United States. And it just so happened that he hit a jackpot because he knew what where he was going. He knew what he was writing about. So, I didn't read the book, but then I seen the picture three times. And I come home and I sat down and I wrote up a little piece about it. The name of this is The Ballad of Tom Joad. Tom Joad got out of that old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come a-walking down the road, poor boy. Tom Joad come a-walking down the road. It was there he found him a truck-driving man. There he got him a ride. Said, I just got a loose from the old penitentiary.
Woody Guthrie sang a song he wrote after he'd seen Grapes of Wrath called Ballad of Tom Joad, borrowing from the melody of classic John Henry John Hardy, as it's also been sung. He sometimes wrote his own melodies, but sometimes he just stuck his lyrics to other songs. He also, he obviously loved that film. He named one of his kids Jody after Tom Joad.
That's right.
So you said while you were listening to this that we're stirring up so many memories for you. You hadn't heard this transcription in all these years?
Of course not. I didn't even know of its existence until just about a year ago.
Mm-hmm. It had been in the collection of Morris Novick, the
station
manager.
Yes, because it was, that's right, because it was on one of those 16-inch, transcription discs. And most of the time, since we had no recordings, I never paid any attention when they dropped the needle and recorded it. So that was it. But I first heard it on one of the early programs called Adventures in Music, and we were doing a program on Kentucky and the Kentucky mines, and the strike that had gone on there for 20 years and the struggle, to form a union. And then at the end of the program, I hadn't noticed, but because my friend Paul Krish had written the script, that somebody came over to me and said, hey, do you see that guy, that little guy with the wiry hair? He's Woody Guthrie. And I said, my goodness, I think I've heard about him. Maybe I think I've heard it from Pete Seeger. So I went over to him and I said, Woody, I have heard about you and I heard that you wrote a song, Tom Joad, based on the movie. And he said, yes, I did. I said, would you mind singing it? And he said, no, I don't. And he just moved his guitar, which was always on his back, to the front, which carried a sign, this machine kills fascists. And everybody sat down, silence, not a sound. Woody sang it. And really, the silence deepened in the studio. And finally, when he was through, and I thought to myself, here is this man who is singing about his own people, about the horror of that time, but now he's singing for us too.
So it becomes entertainment as well. How long? You were only there 3 years. Did the show end when you left? Did you leave because they canceled the show?
No. I'll tell you why I left. I mean, I was leaving WNYC because one day there was a telephone call from a very dear friend, Rufino Tamayo, a great Mexican painter, and he said, Olga, his wife, and I have just bought a car, and we're going to Mexico. Will you come? And my husband, who was Argentine-born, and we had known Tamayo's for a long, long time, and said, yes, absolutely, we're going with you.
Your husband was a painter, too.
Yep, my husband was a painter. I went to Mexico. There I remained for 5 years, and for the rest of my life have researched music and primitive music all over the Spanish world. So that's what happened. And then I came back. You know, I kept on coming back and doing research in my own country, and that's been my life for 60 years.
And then you came back to this station for a
little
while.
And then I came back, during the 60s.
Doing a folk music show?
Yeah, it was called, then we just changed the original title. It was called Adventures in Folk Music.
How long did Leadbelly stay here?
He stayed for years after I left. Okay.
Well, Henrietta, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on New York & Company to talk about the show. And our special thanks to WNYC's archivist, Andy Lancet, not only bringing this recording to our attention, but also for putting it into a format that we could use. And let's go out with a little Leadbelly and a very famous song.
Now, people don't always sing about men. Leadbelly's going to sing one of the most beloved of all ballads, The Boll Weevil.
Now, this is a boll weevil. Long years ago, he come through down south. A man, he used to raise 25 and 30 bales of cotton every year, but he didn't make but one bale that year. And after the boll weevil was gone, this is a story he'll tell the people. You can talk about the ladies of your own. These boll weevils, they will rob you of a home. They're looking for home. They're looking for home. First time I seen him, boll weevil, he was sitting on a square. Next time I seen him, boll weevil, he had his whole family there. He's looking for home. He's looking for home. The farmer, he said to the merchant, I never made but one bale. Before I let you have that last one, I will suffer and die in jail, and I'll have a home, and I'll have a home. Now, if anybody should ask you people who come for this song, tell them it's Huddy Leadbelly.